It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we finish up my series of conversations with Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate. Today, we hear from Iowa's former Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge, who is vying for that nomination to run against Chuck Grassley in the fall. But before that, now that it's fairly clear who the presidential nominees from each major party will be, let the Veep stakes begin. Joining us this hour with a glance back at U.S. presidential campaign history for hints about what's going on this year, we're joined by Tim Walch. He is presidential historian, also former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walch, welcome back to our program. So glad to have you.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be here.
Well, we certainly want to talk about the modern day because that's very interesting concerning the vice presidency. But let's root us in history, the history of our republic. At the beginning, how was the vice presidency conceived?
Sure. Let me start with a doggerel. And the story goes this way. There once was a man who had two sons. Both of them left home and were never heard from again. One was a ship captain lost at sea, and the other became vice president of the United States.
What's the origin of that?
I think it goes back to Finley Peter Dunn at the turn of the 20th century, because most of our 19th century vice presidents were forgotten entities, unless, of course, they by chance succeeded to the presidency. So that John Tyler, who of course becomes the first vice president to become president, had been elected vice president under William Henry Harrison, who folks will remember served only 30 days in office. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't clear from the Constitution that the vice president of the United States would immediately succeed to the presidency. The only defined constitutional role for the vice president is to preside over the Senate. Tyler assumed the responsibility, was sworn into office, insisted that he be called president, not acting president, and we established a tradition that has continued. And of course, it's codified in law now by the 25th Amendment of the Constitution. So that, it's an evolving office that throughout, again, most of the 19th century served only as an afterthought.
Mm-hmm. Your questions about the vice presidency throughout U.S. history, distant and modern history. Tim Walch is here to field any of those questions. Presidential historian, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. So we have this in the modern era, but still staying for the moment,
right.
back decades, back a couple centuries. How traditionally in the beginning were vice presidents considered part of the president's inner circle or not?
No. And in fact, the vice presidents of the United States, really up until modern times, up until certainly Lyndon Johnson and Walter Mondale and certainly the more recent vice presidents, did not have an office in the White House. Now, Richard Nixon had an office in the old Executive Office Building, and so they generally got a little closer to the White House. But throughout the 19th century, vice presidents had an office in the Senate. They were generally considered an officer of the Senate. It wasn't clear that they were necessarily part of that administration. So they were largely ignored, didn't play any active role. It was not considered in the 19th century to be a springboard to the presidency. It was more likely that you would get the nomination if you had been Secretary of State. Daniel Webster, I think twice or three times, turned down an opportunity to be vice president. And ironically, he would have been president because he could have been Zachary Taylor's vice president. He could have been William Henry Harrison's vice president. He turned it down to become Secretary of State because he thought that would be the springboard to the presidency. So he chose poorly. But that was how much that office was generally disregarded until the 20th century. In fact, interestingly enough, Theodore Roosevelt, who of course was selected as William McKinley's second vice president, had been kicked out of what was perceived as a more powerful job as governor of New York because he was a pain to the political bosses in New York, made vice president of the United States, had so little to do that he was planning to go to law school at George Washington University while he was vice president of the United States. So it is, again, an office that just didn't have much to do. And power in the presidency is defined by proximity. So when the vice president had an office on Capitol Hill, he was still quite a ways from the White House.
Mm-hmm. And we see that in the current era as well, proximity. I wanted to play this clip, and I'm glad you kind of dovetailed into it because a lot of people know the program Veep. The vice president is played by the actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and she is giving us sort of an inside view of what, well, this fictional vice presidency is like. Here's a little cut. Selina Myers, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is snubbed from a Senate briefing by the president.
You were late.
Yes, and I am incredibly sorry. I was not in my own apartment last night. I overslept.
Okay, having a massive stroke is an excuse for coming in late to this office. Having sex is absolutely not damn
right. Quite right, madam. Although, in my defense, I didn't even think you'd be here.
So. Why?
Well, there's the briefing on the fiscal responsibility bill at the White House. I assumed you'd be there.
I wasn't invited. What? This is happening...
right now.
F*** that POTUS. He did this with the defense budget briefing 2 weeks ago. God. Where is Amy?
You get a gag on top of
the gag. Why didn't I know about this? I'm going. They can't keep me out of there.
Hey, ma'am, I'm right here. Can I get you something?
You got rollerblades?
Okay, Selina Myers, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, being snubbed there. So this has been a constant theme in the modern historical vice presidency. They're in the loop. They're not in the loop. Talk about
that. Well, here's a challenge. If you're selecting a vice president because you feel you need them on the ticket to balance, say, geographic or some sort of a skill set, take, for example, the Kennedy-Johnson ticket in 1960. They were not friends. I mean, they had both been in the Senate. But Lyndon Johnson was detested by Robert Kennedy and others. Robert Kennedy didn't want Johnson selected as vice president. They were shocked when he chose that office. And so there was friction between the Johnson camp and the Kennedy camp through the campaign and into the vice presidency. And Johnson was a very active, he'd been a majority leader. He was looking for activities to do. So they were always trying to find something for Lyndon to do. And that's one of those situations where he was kind of resentful of Robert Kennedy, resentful of not being kept in the loop. And that kind of friction happens periodically. Again, even in the 19th century, if you're forced to run with somebody who is not somebody you're compatible with or somebody whose advice you value, you're going to push them away and therefore diminish the proximity that vice president wants. And just like Selina, she's going to push her way into that meeting.
Right. Talk about some of the other qualities that presidential campaigns look for in a running mate.
Sure.
What does conventional wisdom tell us?
Well, certainly you want somebody who has the right temperament. You don't want somebody who's going to blow up or be difficult with the president. They have to keep in mind that they are there to assist the president. They are not the president. They don't run their own separate vice presidential campaign. So you have to have the right temperament. You have to have a set of skills that would make that person ready to become president if something were to happen to the president of the United States. So they have to be competent. They should bring a certain measure of excitement to the ticket. I mean, one of the challenges of picking somebody who has a lot of competence is it might be somebody very familiar to everybody and therefore doesn't bring much energy. You want a big bounce and bump out of the convention. And so sometimes you go with excitement, and that can be a problem, and that surprise can come back and bite you.
Mm-hmm. Let me pick up on that point of excitement there, because we certainly had that in 2008. John McCain was then to be running against then Senator Barack Obama. And all of a sudden at the GOP convention in the summer of 2008, we heard this voice. Many Americans heard this voice, of course, governor of Alaska, but many of continental Americans heard this voice for the very first time.
To serve and defend America, and I accept the challenge of a tough fight in this election against confident opponents at a crucial hour for our country. And I accept the privilege of serving with a man who has come through much harder missions and met far graver challenges and knows how tough fights are won. The next president of the United States, John S. McCain.
Okay, I remember that day. I'm sure you do, Tim Walsh, as well. It was exciting. It was electrifying.
Right.
And there was a lot of praise heaped on this decision initially.
That's right. So, this is Sarah Palin, governor of Alaska, recently elected. She'd been governor for about 18 months. Before that, the mayor of Wasilla, self-declared hockey mom. And she had a resume, at least on the surface, that stimulated a lot of positive response, and it was an electrifying speech to the convention. But, of course, that's the challenge in part is, did they have enough time? The McCain campaign, because they were behind in the polls, they knew that the Obama candidacy would have a lot of excitement to it. They wanted some excitement out of the convention. They picked a woman. So first Republican woman to be nominated for vice president, a governor, which was good. That's a nice compliment to McCain's role as senator. But then all of a sudden, and on the surface, all the vetting seemed fine. But then they learned certain things. Her husband had been a member of a fringe political party. Their daughter was pregnant but not married. All of these little things, which apparently they weren't quite aware of initially, comes back to hurt them. And then, of course, people began to sort of to lampoon her speaking style, and she was cursed by Saturday Night Live and the
I can
similar
see a, I can
appearance.
See Russia from my doorstep.
Yeah, I can see Russia from my doorstep. The Katie Couric interview where she was asked by Katie Couric, you know, what newspapers do you read? And she froze. I mean, she hadn't really given enough thought to it. Prepping these vice presidential candidates, if they haven't had a public life, a large-scale public life, a member of the Senate or something like that on the national stage, your mindset may not be in that that vein. And so consequently, all of a sudden, you're caught. And then, no doubt, Palin became defensive and pushed back. She felt she was under attack. Folks who are familiar with the book Game Changer, the HBO television program, have seen that portrayal. Now, probably parts of it I'm sure she would disagree with. But the bottom line is we've had vice presidential candidates in the recent era where people have lampooned them. Obviously, Vice President Quayle and his spelling of the word potato. Or trying to compare himself to John F. Kennedy and Lloyd Benson coming back at him and saying, I knew John Kennedy, you're no John Kennedy. All of a sudden, the vice presidency, which you thought might be a stepping stone to the presidency, has become a millstone, not a stepping stone.
What about this quality that we always hear about the attack dog, that the vice presidential candidate can do things the presidential candidate doesn't stoop to?
Well, and
sort
you know,
of?
This emerges from Richard Nixon, who was asked to carry that role. Eisenhower did not want to attack Stevenson. He didn't want to appear unpresidential, but he had this young vice presidential candidate, Richard Nixon, who had had a role, an aggressive role of attacking Helen Hagen Douglas in his Senate campaign and had attacked Alger Hiss and so forth. So Nixon had a role as being sort of a prosecutor and an attack dog. So he did that in the 52 and 56 campaigns. And so when he became a candidate again in 68, he said, I'm going to choose a vice presidential candidate who can do what Ike made me do, thereby choosing Spiro Agnew. And you remember Agnew came up with phrases like nattering nabobs of negativism for the press and things. I think that was a Pat Buchanan line. But the point was, yeah, there are roles that vice presidents are asked to do that are assigned by the president because maybe the president doesn't want to introduce that role or take that role, both positive and negative at that time. So the vice president does what the president asked them to do. And behind closed doors, they ask for advice as well.
We have some exceptions to that, too. Also, in the modern era, when we talk about the relative power of a vice president. Now, let's go to what I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, the most powerful vice president in U.S. history in recent times, Dick Cheney.
Well, yes, and Joe Biden, because in effect, what you've got are two men who were about as close to their respective presidents as can be imagined, at least in the modern era. That is, they met weekly or more often with their presidents. Those presidents valued the advice that they received. And so, yes, I think from the point of view of those two respective political camps, with the Republicans and Democrats, it's Cheney and Biden.
Okay, so I wanted to play another little bit of audio. This is Joe Biden, vice president in 2012. You talked earlier about how the vice president has to be in lockstep with the president on certain issues. Tell me if something was going wrong here. Vice President Joe Biden became the highest ranking official in the Obama administration in 2012 to signal support for same-sex marriage. This was during an interview with Meet the Press. Note that before this, President Obama had was out in favor of came out in this was before
right.
the president came out in favor of same-sex marriage. In fact, during his 2004 Senate campaign, then Obama said, "I have been very clear on this. I have said I am not a supporter of gay marriage." 2004. So here's President Vice President Joe Biden in 2012 being interviewed out in front of his president.
I am Vice President of the United States of America. The president sets the policy. I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying women are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
Okay, Joe Biden stepping over the line there?
Well, you know, Joe Biden had a reputation for kind of stepping on his tongue or saying things out of turn. So that's kind of the narrative that was popular among the general public. I find it hard to believe, though, as politically savvy as the vice president is, as Joe Biden is, that he went out and said something that had not been vetted with the chief of staff at the White House and others. So I suspect that the president knew that this was ready to be floated, and the vice president had an opportunity to say this on Meet the Press. So you might call it a soft rollout of presidential policy by having the vice president do it. That is a supposition without basis of documentary evidence, which I deeply value. But I suspect at a future point in the vice president's papers and the maybe even the presidential papers, we'll learn that in effect it had been approved by the White House and approved by the president.
We know modern presidential candidates pick vice presidential candidates to get this so-called bounce.
Yes.
Is that a bounce of any significance usual? Is it a lasting bounce? Does it help in the—
No. I think generally, and in fact, some will remember Vice President Schweikert. That was the vice presidential candidate that Ronald Reagan chose in 1976, or Vice President Fiorina that the presidential candidate Ted Cruz chose. So they really don't get the bounce they're hoping for, but they're looking at that point, without being overly cynical, for some attention during a news cycle. And then they want to have it come out of the convention. In the case of, say, Senator McGovern, who chose Senator Eagleton, who was a good friend of his, it came back that Senator Eagleton had electroshock therapies, and of course he had to remove Senator Eagleton from the ticket. So that lack of candor on Eagleton's part led eventually, of course, to Sergeant Shriver becoming the vice presidential candidate, but that had hurt the ticket to some extent. So generally speaking, people aren't going to vote for a ticket because of the vice president. You're looking for some attention. Maybe you get a couple of news cycles. You want somebody who's going to do reasonably well in the vice presidential debate. That's become a tradition now.
Yep.
So that competence, that ability to think on your feet is very important. And prepping the vice president, again, has to be prepared from day one to take over the office if something were to happen to the president. So they've got to know all of the various nations on this earth and our policy related to those nations. And
almost
so
an
forth.
Inhuman quality of an encyclopedia.
Well, particularly if being selected as a vice president is a complete surprise to you. I mean, if you chose somebody who hadn't thought of themselves as vice president or didn't think in those terms, so if you weren't prepping yourself as you were going along or had been a presidential candidate yourself, the vetting process takes a number of weeks, except for those people who had put their name forward to be a presidential candidate. The press had kind of vetted them. Those are your safest choices. But to choose one of your other rivals isn't very exciting to the press or the general public. So you're caught between, do I pick somebody completely, as a surprise, but then run the risk that there might be something in their background, or do I choose somebody safe?
All right. For months, buzz about Hillary Clinton picking Bernie Sanders as the running mate. That would be a team of rivals, as Barack Obama did with Hillary Clinton.
Right, and it may be necessary. It may be necessary if the Clinton people feel that the only way they're going to bring the Sanders supporters into the mix is to by putting him on the ticket, then that's going to be a safe choice, and it would not surprise me at all.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, there's all kinds of names that are being suggested. There may be people who will refuse, although the Republicans seem to be rallying behind Trump now, but there might have been people. Well, certainly I don't think Jeb Bush is going to choose to be Donald Trump's vice president. But, you know, and I'm told Marco Rubio has taken his name out, and I'm sure there are others as well. So it's going to be a challenge.
Tim Walz, we have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to have us look at this unconventional election right. cycle as a whole, stepping back, not necessarily to do with vice presidents, but with the Trump and Sanders insurgency campaigns from the outside in this year's presidential campaign. Is there any other historical elections that you can look back on where it has been such a surprise for outside candidates?
You know, it's one of those things where you do see the rivalries helping to define who's going to be chosen as the vice president. And that's what you saw in Kennedy and Johnson. And we look back on vice presidential selections based on would this individual be a good president of the United States? In some cases, the biggest surprise, say, for example, with FDR, was bumping Henry Wallace off the ticket and choosing Harry Truman, this unknown senator from Missouri who turned out eventually to become one of the greatest presidents of the United States. That was an inspired vice presidential pick, but a complete surprise. Mm-hmm. Again, and he is FDR's third vice president. And I challenge most people to remember who the other two were. I said Wallace already. But does anybody remember Jack Garner? He's the fellow who said that the vice presidency isn't worth a pitcher of warm. He said, well, everyone says it's spit, but it was a more earthy term than that. And he was really an opponent of FDR. He said he should have stayed as Speaker of the House so he could have stopped the New Deal. So in some cases, they choose vice presidential candidates who aren't compatible with the president at all.
And it's also important to have a vice presidential candidate who doesn't outshine the president.
Well, yeah, and absolutely. The vice president doesn't run on their own. They stand in the president's shadow. They're at the president's side, but they're not in front of the president.
Okay.
And again, that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Okay. That fellow's name was Jack Garner?
Cactus Jack Garner, John Nance Garner of Texas.
You know what? We don't have to remember those names because we have you, Tim Walz, to remember all those facts and figures. Thank you so much for spending a half hour with us. Tim Walz is a presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. We're so glad he's stuck around these parts here in Iowa to stop in and lend us his expertise. Thanks again, Tim.
Glad to be with you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we finish up my series of conversations with Democratic U.S. Senate candidates by talking with Patty Judge, former Lieutenant Governor of Iowa under Chet Culver, also former Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, former State Senator Patty Judge from Albia. And you can join our conversation. It's a live conversation with Patty Judge. Tell us, what are the issues that define this primary for the U.S. Senate? 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment.